The Lord reigneth. Let the earth rejoice. Let the multitude of isles be glad thereof. Clouds and darkness are round about him. Righteousness and judgment are the habitation of his throne. A fire goeth before him and burneth up his enemies round about. His lightnings enlighten the world. The earth saw and trembled. The hills melted like wax at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the Lord of the whole earth. The heavens declare his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. Confounded be all they that serve graven images, that boast themselves of idols. Worship him, all ye gods. Zion heard and was glad, and the daughters of Judah rejoiced because of thy judgments, O Lord. For thou, O Lord, art high above all the earth. Thou art exalted far above all gods. Ye that love the Lord hate evil. He preserveth the souls of his saints. He delivereth them out of the hand of the wicked. Light is sown for the righteousness, and gladness for the upright in heart. Rejoice in the Lord, ye righteous, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness.
Once more, we have visitors with us that we're privileged to have in our midst. We are always blessed with many visitors, and we're glad that you can be here to worship with us today. I feel like a visitor myself. I'm glad to be back home. I never knew 3 weeks could pass so slowly and so rapidly at the same time, and it's with mixed emotions that I left, but it was not with mixed emotions that I came home. I'm glad to be back without any reservations at all. As I began to get ready to come home, when John and I had finished the 3 weeks of work, I got home about 10 minutes before John did to the motel. And when he came in, I had already packed. And I was dancing a jig in the kitchen of the motel, clapping my hands and jumping up and down. And I said, John, when I get back to Searcy, those kids and my friends of my own age, I said, let me tell you what they're going to do for me. I'm going to get hugs, handshakes, half Nelsons, and hammerlocks. I said, they're very expressive of their love. They're very loving, and they find it easy to express their love. And I was not disappointed. I've received the hugs and the handshakes and the hammerlocks and the half Nelsons, and it's always good to return, but especially this time it was good. I want to tell you how loving I think you really are, the vast majority of you, not just toward me, but toward each other, and toward the older people who are here in your midst, and how very expressive you are of that love, and I love you for it. Especially did it stand out for me this time because we were there for 3 weeks among a group of people who, for the most part, had lost that capacity of heart to reciprocate love. They had not always lost it, or they had not always been without it. Not all of them had even lost it now. And some of them never had it. But there was lacking in that visit what we had known while we lived there from 65 to 70. There was this lack of genuine love that had been squeezed out of the congregation somehow or other. And the lack of it had set in. And I regretted it. And because of the lack of it, I felt all the more the yearning for you that I have. The leadership of that congregation had fallen into the hands of a few men who, for one reason or other, had not been able to develop in the area of the reciprocating kind of love that is necessary for leaders to possess if a congregation is to prosper. And consequently, the life of that church was being squeezed out of it. And a pall of death was beginning to settle over the whole church. And by the grace of God, it was broken, and we were able to turn it around and start it out on a new course. While I was there, someone told me of one of their kinsmen. I don't know who it was now, or I don't know who the kinsman was, but I remember someone telling me that one of their kinspeople had, just the week prior to our coming, undergone open heart surgery. And the problem was that the sac around the heart had become fibrous, or it not calcified, but it had become thickened and it had died and had actually become a cage around the heart and had formed a prison around the heart, and that cage had to be cut out. And in order for the heart to be able to function in its proper way. And I thought how unusual an illustration of the problem that church had. And we had to go in there with the surgery and the knife of the Word of God and cut free the heart of those people and liberate it from that stranglehold that had been gained, and let those people breathe free once again. And it was in that kind of a setting that 2 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, verses 11 through 13, literally jumped off of the page and came out living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword. I want to read it for you this morning, and I want to draw a lesson from it for us today. It's a strange passage. Listen to it. Our mouth is open to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide. You are not restricted in us, but you are restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children, widen your hearts also. It's a very unusual passage of Scripture. There's one key word in it, and it's the word that's translated here, affections. Now that word in the Greek is a very unusual word. Not that it's so unusual, but we don't quite know what to do with it. In the King James, it's translated bowels. And the King James translation just simply says, you are straitened in your own bowels. It makes you think that the people at Corinth had stomach cramps or something, is the way it comes across. Of course, that's not what he was talking about. But translators have struggled with that thing, not knowing really what it was that it was talking about. Because the word in the Greek language literally is bowels. It's intestines, the word splagnon, or splanon. And it gives this, it is, that's exactly the literal translation of it. If you were to translate it, it would be bowels or intestines. He is talking about gut-level living. And I have apologized for using that expression before you, but that's exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about living in the area of your makeup where it is at gut-level living. And he's talking about that particular part of your makeup that is so near the center and core of your very existence that if this becomes faulty or defective, you've got real trouble on your hands. This obviously will have to be treated as an idiom. And in translating it from one language to another, you don't translate it literally. you translate the meaning of it and not the word itself. And so when it was translated in later translations, they translated it affections. But what he's talking about is that part of our makeup, emotional, spiritual, that has to do with our soul, that has to do with everything about us that's so right down to the very heart of us that sometimes the word is translated heart. In this particular passage, it's translated affections. But he's talking about the kind of existence, the area of existence that houses tender affections. The kind of affections that are kindness, benevolence, tender emotions, and things of this nature that really get down where we actually live. And the Greek people felt those emotions here in the trunk of their body. And consequently, they called them their bowels. We know that's not where they originate. We know we are affected there. But nevertheless, that word is the key word in this passage of Scripture. There are two other words that are used by Paul here, and I beg your patience, as I'm going to tell you the Greek words, and I know that you'll just have to bear with them, but I think that they're that important. The two words that describe the difference between the Apostle Paul and the Corinthians, and that describe the difference between what the Corinthians were and what they ought to be, are words that are familiar to us in our own English language. One of them is the word stenokoreia, or stenokoreo, the verb. From it, we get our word stenographer. The word stenokoreo means to compress, to bring down into a small, compact, tight situation that you can barely move in. That's what a stenographer does. He or she takes a whole lot of words and reduces them down into a very small space. That's what he says here happened to these people. He said, you've become restricted. You've become compressed. You have become ground down or compressed into a small area that you really can't operate in. And he accuses them of having this disease of restrictionitis. In a book called The Synonyms of the Greek New Testament by Trench, he refers to the reign of Queen Elizabeth of England and says that during her reign, certain people in the English or in the Kingdom of Great Britain were tortured by being placed in a compartment that had been designed and its proportions or its size was so small and the design of it was of such a nature that the people could not stand up, walk, sit, or lie fully stretched out in any position. And that was the type of torture that they were subjected to. Can you imagine being in that type of a compartment for very long? Well, that's what the word stenokoreo implies. It implies being crammed down into some place that's just extremely uncomfortable. This building, before we expanded it, and I didn't intend this to be used at all. I didn't plan it like this. It came to me early this morning. This building, before it was expanded, was a stenokoreia. It was very uncomfortable, really. We were up elbow to elbow. You had to get here 15 minutes early to find a seat. You were sitting on top of each other. And if the fire department had caught us in here on some of the days that we had been in here, they would have put all of us under the jail. We really would have been in prison. But this kind of a word is what he's talking about here. Or this kind of a concept is what he's portraying with this word stenokoreia. He says you've actually been put in a position that's very uncomfortable, out of which you really can't operate. Then the other word, the second word that describes what they ought to be, was the word platuno. And it is the word from which we get the word plateau or platform. or other words with the root word plat, that imply a broad expanse, an area that gives room, a flat place where you can finally breathe fresh air and begin to operate and function again. And these words are used not just here in this passage here. They're used throughout not only New Testament literature, but Old Testament literature, and also in secular literature of the Greek people. This was a very appropriate contrast between being crammed down into a small compartment when you really ought to be liberated and free to operate. Now, the Apostle Paul uses these three words to describe the condition of these Corinthian people. Number one, he says, you've got affection problem. He said the problem is that you are restricted in your own affections. And then thirdly, he says you ought to be free. You ought to enlarge your hearts. Let me read it again and tell you what he says. Our mouth is open to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide. You are not restricted by us, but you're restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children, widen your hearts also. The Apostle Paul not only defines and describes their condition, he gives the cause of their condition. First of all, he says it was not because of anything that he had done. Paul says, our heart is open to you, or our heart is wide and our mouth is open. I wondered for years and years, what difference would it make to anybody whether Paul's mouth was open or shut? I couldn't figure out what he was talking about. It finally dawned on me on this trip what he was talking about. These two things he was saying. When he said that our heart is wide, it's broad. Our affections have not been limited, Corinthians. He said, we've given ourselves without reservation to you, and there's nothing that I could do more than what I have already done for you. Our heart has been wide enough to incorporate, to include every one of you within your needs or for your needs and within the scope of our care. And then he said, our mouth is open. He simply says, I have communicated this need or this care of your needs to you. I've communicated this love that we have tried to express to you. I have communicated it to you so that you could know what we felt about you. Francis Schaeffer, in one of his recent books, says that two of the needs that the world has today that are most pressing are, one, the need to be loved, and secondly, the need to hear that love expressed. There are people who can love, but they can't express that love. There are men who love their wives, but they can't express it. And the wife goes through life not ever hearing her husband say that he loves her. That's an unfortunate situation, but it exists. But Paul says neither one of these things existed on my part. He says, I loved you, and I told you about it. He simply says in verse 3 of this chapter, we put no obstacle in anyone's way so that no fault may be found with our ministry. But as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way through great endurance in afflictions. Now listen to the list of the things that he says that he did for these people and see if you can add anything to it. Through great endurance in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, tumults, labors, watching, hunger, by purity, knowledge, forbearance, kindness, the Holy Spirit, genuine love, truthful speech, and the power of God, with the weapons of righteousness for the right hand and for the left, in honor and dishonor, in ill repute and good repute, we are treated as impostors and yet true, as unknown and yet well known, as dying and behold we live, as punished and yet not killed, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing all things. That's one of the most profound, all-inclusive undressing of a man's heart and soul and mind before the eyes and the ears of an audience of people who had great needs that you can find in any writing in human language. I don't know of anything else that the Apostle Paul could have said that he did for these people than what he says here. And his life backed it up. They knew that. Paul had not held himself back. Paul had emptied himself. He had literally poured himself out, he says, as an offering upon their altar
of sacrifice to God as a libation. He had literally poured himself out for these people. And he says, now also, not only is my heart wide, he says, I have told you about it. I have communicated it to you where you know how we feel about you. So he says, you're not restricted in our because of us. And I think I can state the same thing about the work that was done in the city of Christchurch, New Zealand. And I'm not saying this in defense of myself. And I know you're not really all that interested in that work, but I got this message out of that work, and I want to just simply relate it to it and then pass on. On behalf of my wife and myself and the workers that I knew who were there with us, I'll have to say I don't know of a single thing that I could have done more than what I did. I don't know of a thing that my wife could have done more than what she did, nor the other workers, what they could have done more than they did. And then when John Payne and Rita replaced Louine and me there in 1970, I saw in that young man and woman a love that grew and surpassed what we had for those people. I thought I loved them, but I don't love them like John Payne loves them. The night that he stood up in the building there on Saffron Street, the last week that we were there, and told those people that if arrangements were not made with one of the preachers in the two islands to come there periodically for about 6 months, that if arrangements were not made, that he himself would stay there with them, he would not leave them, that he would send me on back home by myself, and he would stay over there. And then further, he said, if we don't get someone to come in and carry you on through about another year and a half, he said, I and my wife and family will move back over here and we'll stay with you. We're not going to leave you alone. We're not going to let you fail. Well, I cried. I wept. Because I knew I didn't have that in me. I knew it was beyond my capacity. And I stood and simply said, I want to concur with John's evaluation of your problem, but I said, that's not really what's necessary. I said, I think your own heart concurs with it. It endorses what he said. But I said, I want you to know something tonight. If you never, ever know it again, I want you to know tonight that you've been loved by someone. I said, I thought I loved you. And I do love you, and I did love you, and I still love you. But I said, I don't love you like this man loves you. He loves you with a love that surpasses. And you know what? That whole church knew that. And it broke them. They couldn't stand it. They wept. And that ugly sore, or if you want to keep it in the figure that I have, that ugly dead housing that had grown around the heart of those people began to be broken, and they began to breathe free. They wept. They embraced. And once more, they were allowed to be free, at least of the restriction that envy and jealousy and hatred had imposed upon them. Paul was not really concerned about their attitude toward him, though that's the context in which he writes it. He was concerned about the effect that it was having upon themselves. John and I, neither one, was concerned about the effect of their love upon us. I could recover. The lack of their love to me, the lack of their love for John, would not permanently affect either John or me. But I could see what effect it was having upon themselves. For example, when we got off of the plane, a group of Christians met us. And I saw in that group of Christians a man and his wife who in former years had been the very epitome of warm love, especially in the last few years as they had grown to it. And yet I saw this woman as she walked up to greet us. She looked like death warmed over. She's not but about 35, and yet all of her warmth, her love, all of that, it seems, just had vanished away, and she stood there like a corpse.
And I thought, oh me, something's really happened that's bad. I wonder what it is. We went to her home. John and I talked with them. We said, what's the matter? What's happened? Well, they talked about it. We knew that it had to do with the split in the church that had come some 6 months earlier. But then all of a sudden, it seems that there came from something way down inside her, down toward where the Greeks would have called her bowels, inside her very being, there came this rush of tears and this convulsing sobbing, and she came out with this blurting statement. She said, I hate those people. She said, I hate them. And she sobbed and she sobbed uncontrollably. She was being restricted by her own affections. She couldn't bring herself to love people that had hurt her. She couldn't bring herself to do what the Apostle Paul told the Colossian people to do. Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassion, kindness, lowliness, meekness, and patience, forbearing one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these things, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. She couldn't do it. She says, I don't want to be like this. But she says, I hate those people. I think that she got over it. I think that she started healing once that boil or once that sore was broken open. But in the meantime, the people that she was hating were languishing. They were dying. They were drying up. They were over there wanting someone to love them. And then there she was, having imposed upon herself this cage, this restriction, this constriction around her heart, and there she was dying inside simply because of her own affections. I hadn't caused it. John hadn't caused it. But she had caused it and had imposed it upon herself. There was another person, a young man, who did not meet the plane. This young man has a very extreme, difficult time showing love toward his peers, toward people of his own age, toward people of his own standing, his own strength. He can show love for the poor and the maimed and the halt and the blind. He can show love for those who are old, and he can minister until he's literally dropping in his tracks to those people who do not pose any threat to his position. But once a person ever poses as a threat to this boy's position, then all of a sudden he builds for himself a self-imposed prison, and he retreats into that prison and goes back off away from everybody, and by his absence, those who are his peers sense that he really doesn't love them. He has that difficult time doing what Paul told the Romans to do, outdo one another in showing honor. But he can't do it if it's someone who poses a threat to his security. And people languish because of the fact that they sense that he doesn't love them, while he then languishes, drawn back in his shell, self-imposed, again being restricted because of his affections or lack of them. There was another man, and these are just some examples, and these people we have told these very things. So it's not something that I'm doing behind their back. We talked to them and told them these very problems that they had. There was another man there who simply could not love his wife. He couldn't show his love. He couldn't express it. She called John and me and said, please come and help us. She said, in effect, we're dying, and I don't know how much longer we can hold on. This man and his wife, they have some fine children, but he just can't let her know that he loves her. And he can't express to his children that he loves them. How pitiful. There she is, a fine Christian woman, and yet literally dying inside. because the one who is supposed to show tenderness and kindness to her doesn't have that capacity. And he's put her in a bind. He's put himself in a self-imposed prison. And I'll tell you, that's a place where you can't stretch out, stand, sit, or anything else in full relaxation. Listen to what Paul says. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. And then he says, even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church, because we're members of his body. And there she was, dying because he could not bring himself to the point of showing his affections, just simply in simple matters that would convey love and care and concern. There were other people there with one degree or other and one type or other of this same affliction, a lack of affection to the extent that they could not communicate their love for each other and as a result cause each other to be built up. And the church was dying, literally. Now, Paul says you need to do something. He says you need to broaden your hearts. First of all, he says, I did not cause this restriction. You're restricted in your own affections or the lack of them. But then he says that's not to continue. He said you ought to broaden your hearts. That's verse 13. Now, what he was saying, you know, if you put it right down where we are today, he was simply saying one simple thing. Grow up. Grow up. And you're going to be surprised to find how many times in your own life growing up relates to this very simple attribute of being able to experience appreciation and express it, vocalize it to where those to whom you are indebted are aware of it. Let me illustrate it. Young people, the time will have to come in your life when you can say freely, thank you. I appreciate what you've done for me. Young people don't have that naturally, I think. As a child, everything is done for them and they have this incoming to where they feel like it's expected and, you know, what's the difference? I've got it coming to me. The time when you are able to understand that someone has done something for you and you're able then to say thank you, I appreciate it, and reciprocate that same love in return, then, young people, you're growing up. And I doubt that you'll ever be worth the amount that it would take to blow your head off. You'll not be worth 2 cents to society, to yourself, to your husband, to your wife, to the community, until you're able to finally come to the place that you say, thank you. I appreciate what you've done for me. How many years have we wasted with our mothers and fathers? Not being able to tell them, mother, thank you for what you've done for me. I love you. Or daddy, thank you for what you've done. I love you for it. Why is it that we have to wait until we have our own children who grow up to be the same age that we are? Why do we have to wait through all those years until we have children at the age that we were, you know, before we understand and appreciate what our mothers and fathers have done for us? By that time, it's too late. By that time, your mother and daddy may already be dead. And then you'll live a life of regret because of the fact that you didn't grow up in your emotional makeup until it was too late. How many of you keep yourselves back from your peers? I don't mean the ones that are lovely and lovable. I'm talking about those who are not lovely, those who are unlovely. How many of us hold ourselves back from the unlovable and the unlovely and build this shell of protection around about us and ostracize those people and set them apart, and yet they're the very ones who need loving the most? But And because we're restricted in our own affections, because we're restricted in our own ability to reciprocate love to those who show it and initiate love to those who need it, and then finally return love and goodwill for hate and ill will, we find ourselves shutting people out and causing this cloud of despair to settle over all of our relationships. What about our teachers? Can you say it yet to your teachers, "Thank you, I appreciate all you've done for me"? The teachers in this community could very well read and say what Paul says here. As servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way through great endurance in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, tumults, labors, watching, hunger, by purity, knowledge, forbearance, kindness, the Holy Spirit, genuine love, truthful speech, and on they could go. And so many times the teachers would have every right to say, "We did not restrict you. You're restricted in your own affections. Broaden your hearts. Grow up." I remember a teacher of mine when I was in college. I didn't like her. She was snooty and highfalutin, I thought. But I was just simply a big bore. I failed a course under her, the only course I ever failed in my entire life. But it wasn't the course I failed. It was myself. I failed myself. Finally got up enough nerve to go sit down beside her one day and find out who she was. And I found out that she had never married. But I thought I knew why she had never married. But I came to find out that she had never married because she had an invalid mother. And she had chosen to give up her life of a married life and remain at home to take care of her mother. How I needed to grow up. I grew up that day some. That woman today is in a mental institution. I don't know how much strain has been put on her and how much of that it played a part in her present mental illness. I don't know how much part I played in it, but I've wished many a time that I had had the capacity to reciprocate the love and the sacrifice that she showed toward me and toward the other students. Grow up. And it's awfully, awfully closely related to being able to genuinely feel appreciation and to say thank you. May I ask you a question in closing? What prison are you living in? What stenochoria, what tight, cramped place have you self-imposed upon yourself? Resentment? Reservation? Rebellion? What is it that you've imposed upon yourself that's causing you to be cramped in a position that you really can't operate out of as a genuinely free human being? May I simply remind you that it's because of your own limitations. It's your own restriction placed upon yourself because of your lack of ability to reciprocate love and goodwill. You've imposed it upon yourself. We all do. But Jesus Christ will come in and he'll take that heart and he'll cut that old calcified, fibrous growth that has encircled our hearts. He'll take it and cut it loose and sew you back up and let you then begin to operate as a complete and free individual. There may be those of you today here whose attitudes toward other people have been the cause of their being killed a little bit at a time every day, and yourself being put in a tighter and tighter and tighter bind in a self-imposed prison. Paul says, our heart is open, our mouth is open. You're not restricted because of us. You are restricted because of your own affections. Now, he says, in return, you broaden your hearts, grow up. May God bless us to be able to do that very thing. If you're here today and you're not a Christian, he invites you to come and take upon yourself this new heart. But for those of us who are Christians, and most of us here are, it's a constant fight to keep this thing from again developing around us and enclosing us in a position that's uncomfortable and unchristlike. Are you in prison today? Then get out, break loose, make broad your hearts, and make it known right now, if you need to, while we stand and sing.
I bring my sins to thee, the sins I cast.